Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly, bringing the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live to Politics Up the Boring Bits Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, our tour of Britain continues. We went to Bournemouth for the Lib Dems, we went to Manchester for the Tories, Liverpool for the Labour Party, and now we're at lovely Cheltenham, the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival, with a very special live debate in front of an audience of several hundred people. Well, we're asking, what year is it? So here it is. Welcome to the Times radio debate, here with a live audience at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Yay! I'm Matt Chorley. And because we're now probably only a year away from the next general election, we brought together some of the biggest electoral brains in the country to try to find out what we can learn from the politics of the past and find out which election in history 2024 could most closely resemble. Will it be a 1997-style landslide? Could the Tories pull off a surprise like John Major in 1992? Or could it be, and this is my favourite, at such a tight result that we have two elections, like we did in 1974? It probably won't exactly resemble any of those, but we're going to have fun finding out and learning from history. So, joining me on stage here at the Forum at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, Aisha Azarika, Times radio presenter. She also used to be an advisor to Ed Miliband. Hello, but I know you hate me reminding you of that. Hello, Aisha.
Hello. We've
also got Patrick McGuire, Times radio senior political correspondent, who also writes an excellent column in the Times every Friday. Lara Spirit, the Times Red Box editor. I know you're all Times subscribers. You'll be getting her Red Box newsletter in your inbox every morning. And the man that everyone turns to whenever the word election is even mentioned, the sophologist, Professor John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde. Welcome to the panel. So, let's take a trip down memory lane. This is Aisha's choice as we kick off with a look back at previous elections and what they might tell us about the future. Here's a little clue.
I mean, we have been through a big process of change and modernisation of the Labour Party. That is absolutely true. But it's been a process of change that I think has been well worth undertaking.
Either I'll be back in Downing Street or we'll have a Labour government. Does that matter? Yes, it does.
There it is, 10 o'clock, and we say Tony Blair is to be Prime Minister and a landslide is likely.
So, Aisha, are we heading for a 1997-style Labour landslide?
So, I am slightly twisting the question, but I think we are in 1997 territory. I don't think it's necessarily going to be a landslide.
John just laughed.
I know. Slightly done me in right from the start. And the god of politics just ridicules you right from the start. John, just go with me. Before you tell me apart, just go with me. So I think there will be a Labour victory. I think it will be a majority. But this is why I think we're in that kind of zone. That sort of the things, the kind of similarities. First of all, I think the level of unpopularity towards the Tories feels very similar now as it did in the run-up to 1997. Many of you, I'm looking at the old, many of you will remember the 90s very, very well. Don't mean to be rude. Maybe the 1890s. Don't like lose the audience here. But, you know, there was that feeling, wasn't there? There was that feeling that, you know, people really, really wanted to change. I think we're very much feeling that now. I concede that Tony Blair was an exceptional performer. I don't think Keir Starmer is quite... If Tony Blair was a rock star, Keir Starmer is more a sort of folk star kind of thing. Although, to be fair to him, he is doing the job that John Smith, Neil Kinnock and Tony Blair did. He's kind of trying to do that in one truncated thing. The other thing, you've got the mini-budget, which I think is very akin to Black Wednesday, which really...
The Liz Truss one last year,
which I think had a big kind of hangover in terms of... Even though the economy actually started to grow under the Tories never quite won back trust in terms of the economy after that. I think there was that feeling of a real lack of trust in politics, particularly around sleaze. Yep. You know, there was all of this kind of stuff from, cash for questions. You had Neil Hamilton. You had the Jonathan Aitken stuff. Even the David Mellor thing, you know, with the Chelsea shirt and his mistress at the time. That's a memory no one...
You need to explain, Aisha.
Yes.
Was he wearing a Chelsea...
No, he wasn't. I think it was a Max Clifford fabric.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Up. But I mean, there was kind of sex and sleaze scandals. And while individually each one, there wasn't one single one that brought down the government. It felt like the accumulative weight.
Yeah, whereas because John Major was saying back to basics.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then actually, of course, we eventually discovered that he himself was in a relationship with a rather famous lady who wasn't his wife.
Yeah.
Popping out for a curry. Yes.
Which I should say, for the purposes of clarification, nobody has accused Rishi Sunak of.
He's definitely not having an affair with Edwina Curry. I think we could absolutely categorically rule that out. But look, so that's why I do... The other thing which I think was interesting, which is then and now, then as well, you saw the rise of the kind of non-political, kind of anti-sleaze, anti-traditional politics campaigner. Like, remember Martin Bell, the former BBC war correspondent? I think you're seeing the rise of those campaigners. They're much maligned, but, you know, the Gary Linekers, the Carol Vordermans, who have lots of kind of influence, particularly on social media. So that's
Carol
why...
Carol Vordermans are new Martin Bell.
Maybe. She does like a white dress. I don't know. She slightly wears it better than Martin Bell would. But anyway, so that's why I think... I'm not saying it's going to be exactly the same, but I think the conditions are aligned.
Are similar.
But there is clearly one obvious difference, right? There is no way that the Labour Party are going to be able to use Tony Blair's song this time around.
No.
Because the honest truth was, you know, Black Wednesday, although it was politically disastrous for the Conservatives, was arguably brilliant for the economy, and we certainly began to embark on what was proved to be the best period of economic growth in Britain's post-war history. So by the time we got to 1997, although the Labour Party was being extremely careful about what money it might spend, yep, and exactly the same way they're saying now, the truth is the fiscal position was relatively fine and the economy was certainly fine. As Keir Starmer was being very honest with the electorate earlier this week, that is not going to be true after the next general election, not least, of course, because most of the public expenditure cuts that are required to meet Jeremy Hunt's rule, whereby he just about, in the last OBR report, met his rule 5 years down the track, and of course 5 years never happens, they're all scheduled for after the election. So the fiscal position that any new government, whether it's the Conservatives again, or the Labour Party, is going to be much, much tighter.
And I totally, totally accept that. I absolutely accept that. And you're right, the song will not be Things Can Only Get Better. The song will probably be Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now by Morrissey. That's like where things are going to go.
It's one thing saying, look, we're not going to be able to do everything that we want, but to not be able to say things can only get better is such... You know, vote for me and things might get worse seems like quite a tough sell for Keir Starmer.
Well, it is, but they are actually... I think last week's Labour conference, or rather this week's Labour conference, it's been a very long week for those of us from Manchester to Liverpool to Cheltenham. Great place to finish, though. What Labour are now trying to do is move away from the very fatalistic, gloomy language they were speaking in before their conference. Every time, Laura Koonsberg would say, will you buy the country a puppy, Keir Starmer? Keir Starmer would say, absolutely not. Under no circumstances are we going to do nice things. They're making a conscious attempt to move beyond that gloomy rhetoric. But really, the bedrock of their entire economic and political thinking now is the world is a very insecure and scary place with climate change and volatile geopolitics. You know, the very thinking there whole worldview is predicated on means you can't really say things are going to get better. All they can say is things could get worse, but we are the party that respects you and acknowledges the challenges and will try and protect us from the storm we're riding through.
The other thing, Lara, is that the maths is just different. In order, the number of seats that the Labour Party needs to win at the next election, they basically need to make the same gains that Tony Blair did, only to get a majority of one, because they're so far behind.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key differences with 92, which I will anyway be defending. But it is interesting that given Labour look like they're making such significant recovery in Scotland, that is shifting the recovery slightly towards it seeming like actually the distance they do have to go in order to win a majority might just be slightly smaller.
Excellent. So Aisha's made the case for 97 and we've all trashed it. Right.
I just make one other quick point. I think the other thing that happened in 97 that I think we may see at the next election is some big Tory beast losing their seats, yeah, which will be, like Michael Portillo losing his seat. I think there will be, few of those moments.
Michael Gove is currently very active on his Instagram.
He's doing a lot of sewage workshops.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, remember the title of the book after the election was "Were You Up for Portillo?"
Yeah.
Right? And that was the moment when Michael Portillo lost his seat. That was the moment that everybody realised that the Conservatives really were being crucified.
Can I just leave it very quickly and say, John, you might dispute this as someone who knows much more about electoral everything than me. It wasn't in 97 there was an emergence of an awareness among voters that that they could back the Liberal Democrats in seats where Labour had no chance of winning and maximising the anti-Tory vote. And we're beginning to see the first signs of that again, aren't we?
There are remarkable similarities between the patterns of the results in the English local elections in May and the patterns of the results in local elections prior to 1997.
Yes, finally, election. One glimmer of hope.
We're here to pay devil's advocate. There are definitely two things for the Tories to worry about. One is that their votes going down more heavily in the places where they were previously strongest, and under our current electoral system, that's not a terribly good thing to do. And the second thing is, although it won't be on the scale that we're witnessing in parliamentary by-elections, there was clear evidence in the local elections that voters in places that they think the Labour Party are more likely to win, some of the opposition voters were switching to them, and equally they were going to the Liberal Democrats elsewhere. And that's one of the reasons why Labour's chances of getting an overall majority are perhaps somewhat better than the standard arithmetic suggests.
OK, let's move on then. You'll get your chance to trash John now.
Yes, you better watch out, John.
This is John's...
Particularly because I'm going to be much less optimistic for the Labour Party than you.
OK, this is John's pick of the election we should be thinking about. Here's a little reminder.
If it's about the big decisions, I'm your man.
I think if we do things differently, we can be proud once again of the role we can play.
If you vote Conservative, you will get a new team running the country.
I agree with Nick. It's a bigoted woman.
Despite his injuries, UKIP's Nigel Farage was helped from the wreckage.
Here it is, 10 o'clock, and we are saying the Conservatives are the largest party.
I aim to form a proper and full coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats.
Prime Minister, do you now regret when once asked what your favourite joke was, you replied, Nick Clegg?
We're all going to have. I'm afraid I did once. Right.
So, John, 2010. Why should we be thinking about the 2010 election?
Well, once I started to think about it, there are a remarkable number of similarities. Of course, in my case, I'm going to start with the opinion polls. Where were the opinion polls at a year before the 2010 election? There was an 18-point lead for the opposition, very similar to the 17-point lead that the Labour opposition currently have. And yes, the opposition had been ahead in the polls for around 2 years, which is roughly the length of time that the Labour Party has been ahead of the polls in this Parliament. So the starting point, at least, i.e. where we're at now, is remarkably similar to where we were before the 2010 election. Second, of course, similarity is that we had an unelected Prime Minister. Gordon Brown, of course, managed to avoid there being a contest for the prize after Tony Blair decided to resign. So he was both unelected by his party and unelected by the electorate. So to that extent, at least, he shares a similarity with Rishi Sunak.
Former Chancellor as well.
Indeed, absolutely. And then the third similarity, of course, is that Gordon Brown in order to try to deal with the banking crisis, had to engage in unprecedented action, where in effect one bank was was nationalised and another was put into a forced shotgun marriage. Equally, albeit before he was Prime Minister, Mr Sunak engaged in unprecedented action in terms of the government intervening in the labour market in order to save an awful lot of people's jobs. So again, unelected politicians doing remarkably radical things. And then, of course, there is the financial crisis itself. I mean, Aisha's quite rightly referred to Black Wednesday, but then it's also remember that the banking crisis was also a financial crisis, which, much like Liz Truss, the opposition at that stage managed to pin pretty successfully on the government, although we can probably argue that the case for doing so is arguably weaker than that for Liz Truss, but still, the opposition was successful. You remember, you know, the Labour Party was accused of having failed to mend the roof while the sun shone. So again, very, very similar difficulty for the government to deal with. What's also true is that prime ministerial mistakes have played an important role as to why Labour was behind in the polls. Gordon Brown's big mistake, that was basically the pivotal moment when the Conservatives went ahead in the opinion polls, was his failure to call an election in the autumn of 2007, having kind of everybody suggested and allowed the speculation to rise that it was going to be, and then it didn't happen. And so, you know, it's the functional equivalent. Well, basically, it's Boris Johnson and Liz Truss all rolled into one, because it's those two mistakes that result in the system. And then finally, and then this is the reason why, perhaps above all, we should just remember, and I take the conversation Patrick and I have already had, but let's just also bear in mind the Conservatives at that stage were also facing an electoral system that at that stage was working to their disadvantage, and although in the end it did indeed operate to some degree less disadvantageously than it would have done if it had simply followed the geography of 1992, in the end the Conservatives would still have needed an 11-point majority, a lead over Labour in 2010 to get an overall majority, and in the event the 7-point lead they got wasn't enough. And I think it's therefore a lesson, given all these similarities, in the end we cannot rule out the possibility of a hung parliament. We are into the uncertainties of, you know, if Labour are reasonably far ahead, but perhaps not so far ahead as they are now, will they be able to get the majority? And of course the interesting thing then is what would happen afterwards. And here I think I would just simply say one thing. Do not necessarily presume that what the politicians tell you beforehand will necessarily be the truth. And it's worth remembering before 2010, David Cameron was saying that, you know, the prospect of a hung parliament would be chaotic, be an absolute disaster for the country. In the meantime, Oliver Letwin, his principal policy advisor, was desperately reading the Liberal Democrat manifesto. Indeed, I think most people reckoned he knew it better than the Liberal Democrats themselves. And was getting ready.
That was, he was film putting in the
and was getting ready to negotiate. So don't presume that anything that anybody says about what might happen in the hung parliament beforehand is necessary to be believed.
And actually, Lara, you know, the Lib Dems, when down in Bournemouth a couple of weeks ago, you know, Ed Davey answered every single question, apart from the question of what will you do in the event of a hung parliament? Would you go into a cabinet with Keir Starmer?
Yeah, exactly. So that was one of the key ambiguities. Although it seems to be one that actually people are quite happy to let go for a little while now. Although he is unambiguously, and this is different to, you know, 92 or other elections that we'll look at, but he's unambiguously ruling out a coalition with the Conservatives. And indeed, that's kind of the key difference with the Liberal Democrats now, is they've done a complete turn against the Conservatives. And when Ed Davey is asked about...
But it's back to Paddy Ashdown in 1992, because Paddy Ashdown, before 1992, dropped equidistance and said, we were only going with the Labour Party. And of course, that eventually was what Liberal Democrats were hoping to come out of the 97 election, but Labour won by so much and far still, more than the Labour Party ever expected, that therefore none of that...
But it still worked. I mean, they more than, like, doubled the number of seats in 97, the Lib Dems. So, turning their back on the Tories and sort of basically saying we're the Labour Party in places where the Labour Party aren't there matter.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Very good afternoon to you. It's Matt Chorley coming to you live from the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Yeah. And we're sort of playing
sort of parlour game of what general election year is it going to be next year? We've already done 1997. We've done 2010. Now we turn to Lara Spear. And Lara, you're going to sort of set out for us what the two parties themselves might want us to think could happen. So let's start with a reminder first of this one.
I don't believe the United States of Europe is the right way ahead. I do believe a Europe bound together closely, a Europe of nation states bound together, is the right way.
But this is the Labour Party. This is the party that's going to win the election and win for our country.
About half an hour ago, I learnt that we had passed the magic winning post in real seats and not just in a projection. I'm deeply honoured to have been given the opportunity of continuing the work I've started in the last 16 months.
I'm really disappointed we didn't include the Sheffield rally in that.
Very triumphant.
All right. So this is the former Chancellor up against it, pulls off a shock win. That's basically what Rishi Sunak is trying to do, love.
Yeah, so when you talk to Conservative MPs who are still retaining some hope that actually the current poll deficit might be turned around, they will say that actually, if you look at 1992, there is perfect evidence of when you can win from a slight poll deficit and come back. Already laughing within
John's
5 seconds.
I love how you all sat very quietly enjoying John's monologue. And then, yeah, as soon as you start talking, John starts laughing. Anyway, keep going, love.
So the case for this, I think, is threefold. The first is that you have a new-ish Conservative leader in John Major who is making the case that he is very different from his predecessor, who at that point is somewhat discredited, in this case, Thatcher. The second case on this is the Labour leader, Neil Kinnock, who is, like Keir Starmer and like we saw in his speech, coming off the back of what people think is a very successful war with the left of his party. So basically saying, I'm going to disagree with my party, I'm going to leave those factions behind, and I'm going to put country first. So we heard that from Keir Starmer, you know, country first, party second, this week. The third part of this is the election campaign that the Tories say they're going to run. And in this sense, I have to say I'm slightly more sceptical that their comparisons bear a huge amount of weight. But they say, you know, we're intending to run a presidential campaign just like in 1992. So, you know, John's laughing again. Listeners, John's laughing. And in this instance, you know, they say Rishi Sunak is more personally popular sometimes in the party, that actually if we make it all about him and all about him making difficult decisions, and indeed I watched back the John Major, the film that they made about him at the, you know, at hundreds of thousands of pounds of expense to show him going through Brixton and talking about getting inflation down. It's on Conservative Home, have it online. Indeed.
Well, I mean, that's what he says, isn't it? But he's going along in the car.
It's still there. And this is like an Edwardian block, so it would have been unusual if it wasn't.
If it wasn't, and I think one of the problems, obviously, with this, indeed perfectly illustrated by John Major driving through Brixton, is that Rishi Sunak's personal popularity, for those who have read The Times today, is at its lowest.
He could fly over Silicon Valley.
And I think that's one of the problems with this presidential election idea now, which actually some, you know, within the Conservative Party who are allies of Rishi Sunak are starting to admit that actually running a presidential campaign might not be so easy. You know, part of the John Major appeal in that election was him standing famously on the soapbox, him feeling like he could relate successfully to everybody. Indeed, we wrote this morning in Redbox, he was on the Cheltenham soapbox just a few days after his first appearance in Lucerne. I think very hard to imagine Rishi Sunak doing the same. And he hosts those PM Connect events where he goes and speaks to people. And, you know, I met someone who had been with him at one of those events recently, who said, my takeaway from that was that I've never met someone where it's so obvious that he hasn't managed normal people before in his life. And that's what it was like watching him meet all the people that are working here. So I think that's going to be a key difficulty for the Tories in trying to translate Rishi Sunak into a majority. Of course, the reason that they have hope from that is that it looked like Neil Kinnock might win at the beginning of the campaign, and he didn't. But the poll deficit, as I'm sure John will say, was much smaller than it is currently for...
There are two points to make. I mean, one is a point I should make before anybody else does. The polls were wrong in 1992. It is not clear that there was any major change during the election campaign itself. It's just that the opinion polls were exaggerating Labour's position. And that almost... I mean, I think one thing about 1992, therefore, is an important reminder. We shouldn't necessarily assume that the 17-point average estimate in the polls is... it might be exaggerating Labour's position, but there is one fundamental piece of history that does make the 1992 comparison rather difficult for the Conservatives, and that is this. The change in the Conservatives' fortunes even according to the opinion polls, occurred after John Major replaced Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister. So the Conservatives were actually ahead in the opinion polls after Margaret Thatcher was brought down. The same has not happened in the wake of Rishi Sunak becoming Prime Minister. And that's just a fundamental difference. Yeah.
Well, let's move on then, Lara, to the election that Team Starmer have really got their eye on. Here's a reminder.
We shall be partners in a great adventure. We shall consult, and I mean consult, not present you with a diktat.
There would have been, on our calculation, some 300,000 more immigrants come into this country than have done if we had had no legislation. Now, that would have created impossible social and economic problems.
The last figure I saw, which was based on about 610 results, was a 3.6% swing to Labour, and that has, in fact, produced a Labour majority only just.
I think Paul had aspiration to become Prime Minister. Have you still got those ideas?
No, not for politicians. It's a hard life, you see. Yeah. It's a hard day's grind.
There were a few whispers in the audience, Lara, people saying it was 1964. Why does Keir Starmer hope it's 1964?
Well, it's interesting that he mentioned it in his speech. He mentioned it along with the 1945 and 1997 victories that, of course, you know, are well known in Labour history. But 1964, on the surface, appears to bear very similar resemblance. It was the slogan of 13 wasted years of Conservative rule. There was the kind of ready, steady go. You had Harold Wilson facing off against Alec Douglas Hume, who was this figure, this kind of relic of an aristocratic age past that he managed to posit him at. But the key thing being, you know, he's out of touch, he doesn't understand, etc. And in this instance, you know, the thing we associate most with this campaign is, of course, the white heat speech, facing forward to technology, and that was something that Keir wanted to bring out from that. The reason it's a slightly difficult comparison is, of course, that he doesn't want a big enough majority to stay in power very long and has to go back to the country not that long after. And that's actually one of the reasons why it might be a more interesting analogy, because it shows, I mean, some people do talk about this in Labour, and I think Patrick's written about this in one of his columns before, you know, what happens if there isn't a majority or there is the possibility that you may have to go back to the public again. And that's, I think, another reason why it's quite an interesting example of that.
In fact, Patrick McGuire, you spotted when we were in the merch stand at Labour Party conference this week just how seriously they're taking the 64 comparison.
Yeah, if you had bought a Labour Party T-shirt from the merch stall at Labour Party conference, the font was exactly the same as that used in Harold Wilson's campaign in 1964. And the fact I can recognise that font off the top of my head shows you just how much it is I get out.
So that's what the two party leaders, they're the elections that they hope might be emulated next year. Obviously very different outcomes. Patrick, without giving anything else away, what year are you going to be offering up to us?
Well, Aisha already stole a march on me by making an ageist joke about the audience and when they might have first voted. So I'm not going to give anything away. A long time ago.
That's what you call teasing. Right, up next then, Patrick McGuire on an election a long time ago, which might give us some clue as to what might happen next year. It's Matt Trolley coming to you live from the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Yay!
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
We're taking a trip down memory lane to see what we can learn about the coming election from elections past. We've looked at 1997, 2010, 1992, 1964, and now here's a clue to the choice of Patrick Maguire. This was the only bit of audio from this year that we could find, because there were no recordings of any general election at that point. Patrick, what year are we going back to?
I've actually chosen a general election that is so old it predates the invention of domestic radio. And that was the number one song in 1906, which I'm...
also remember.
We've got some 1906 voters in the house. I know that was on the tip of everyone's tongue. You know, you come and hear 1997, 1992, and you think, when is someone going to start talking about 1906? But it sounds eccentric, but once I explain it, I think I might convince you.
So are you saying, Patrick, that most women won't vote in the election that's coming?
Well,
in his dreams.
People do tell me that neither Rishi Sunak nor Keir Starmer are particularly inspiring, so I don't see why they have much reason to. Firstly, to understand 1906, if your patient hasn't worn thin already, we've got to go back briefly to 1900. Now, what happened in 1900? The Tories won 134 seat majority over the Liberals, and it was basically a single-issue election. They called it the Kharkiv election. And that was because the Boer War looked like it had just finished. There was a great wave of patriotic fervour, and the Marquess of Salisbury was returned with a massive landslide. People were saying, well, look, the Conservatives are never going to lose again. This is a one-party state. But in the intervening six-year parliament, several things happened. One, the war dragged on a little bit longer than people were expecting. So the promise of the election, a great sort of victory election, was not fulfilled. Didn't end until 1902. Then, in 1903, a maverick by the name of Joe Chamberlain, who has been agitating for the Conservative Party to adopt protectionist trade policies, been thinking deeply about the Conservatives' relationship with the rest of the world, he leaves the Conservatives. He's a dominant figure in British politics. They used to call him the man that made the weather. He was basically the mafia don who ruled Birmingham as well. So he's a huge figure, creates huge disruption in the Conservative Party, which is then fundamentally split on its fundamental economic policy. Do they back free trade or Chamberlain's preferred system of imperial preference? So by 1906, the Tory party is hopelessly divided on the fundamentals of what it should be for, and the Liberals can mount a campaign that paints them as people who want to increase the cost of living. They talk about the big liberal loaf and the little Tory loaf. And they also can run on a campaign that promises sort of more social protections and the sort of bedrock of what we today call the welfare state. The very first sort of germs of the welfare state were sown in that election. So then what happens? Just checking my notes. The Liberals won 125 seat majority and the Tories fall to 156. That's the lowest seat total the Tories have won in any election ever. Now, why do I make this comparison? Well, because 2019, that is basically, John might dispute this, but it is basically a single-issue election in that Boris Johnson asked for a mandate to break the parliamentary logjam to get Brexit done. Or if you want to spin it another way, the question is, Do you want Jeremy Corbyn as your Prime Minister? And the public answers with a resounding no. Either way, that's a single-issue election. I remember in 2019, 2020, having conversations with Labour MPs with their heads in their hands saying, we will literally never win again. We're dead. We won, you know, barely 200 MPs in this Parliament. You know, I remember having one conversation with a Labour person in which we discussed seriously if you were left-wing on economics now, should you join the Conservative Party and try and shape their policy from the inside? So there was a real feeling that Labour were completely done. But as we've seen over the past 4 years, the big promises that Boris Johnson made in 2019 haven't been fulfilled, and the Tory party now finds itself in a very similar place to it find itself in 1906, namely split fundamentally on its very purpose and overshadowed by some big personalities who've had very, very public disagreements with the course of its policy. So I think that this, actually, obscure though it is, could be a good comparison. And by the way, I'm not alone. I don't know how many of you remember Emily Thornberry's short-lived run for the Labour leadership in 2020. It was a real classic. This is the very comparison she made as well. So, you know, not just me. If you have an issue with that, take it up with Emily Thornberry, KC. Thank you.
I mean, well done, Pat McGuire. Anyone else want to come in on the 1906 election?
Well, I mean,
John's got something to say.
Thomas on the BBC that night.
Yeah. Although you couldn't hear him, there was just a piano playing at the background.
That's why there's no recording. Patrick, I think there's important truth in what you're saying, in that it's also true after the 1992 election. A lot of people were saying, are we heading towards a Japanese-style one-party state, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, the crucial lesson, arguably, is, and the potential analogy is, that arguably the Conservatives lost in 1906 through their mistakes and through their internal divisions. And I think, you know, the honest truth is that probably where we are at now is far more to do with the mistakes made by this government rather than really anything that Labour have done, albeit Labour at least did enough to be able to profit from those mistakes. The other thing, of course, interesting about it, which in a sense argues why, you know, 2019 is an interesting backdrop, is that whole debate inside the Conservative Party about whether it's pro or anti-EU has all sorts of echoes of the debate about imperial preference, both with Joseph Chamberlain and then, of course, again inside the 1920s. And for a long time, there was a debate about whether or not actually this issue would indeed split the Conservative Party again. In the event it didn't, not least because, and here we have to give, we do now have to give tribute to Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson's great success was A, getting his party pretty much all, either they were on side with him in leaving the European Union or they were chucked out. And then B, crucially, he got the Leave electorate, 80% of them, to vote for the Conservatives, and thereby was able to get his 80-seat majority. But you're right, it was very much a one-issue election. That issue hasn't disappeared, but it clearly isn't going to have the same prominence that it did.
Aisha, before I do mine.
Just to pick up on what John said, I think the 2019 thing is really, really interesting. Paula Sturridge, who's a great sort of political sort of academic, wrote a study about the 2019, and they came up sort of with BBC, not the BBC, but they said it's a combination of Brexit, Boris and Corbyn. And I think to just build on what John said about Boris Johnson, slightly sticks in my craw to say it, but he also was, at that point, a kind of phenomenal political campaigner. Yeah. There was a kind of political stardust about him. And because it was such a long time coming, he'd been plotting and planning, and then, of course, all the Brexit kind of stuff, there was an excitement about him that he was quite...
Although, I mean, John will know this, he was nowhere near as popular in the polls.
Well, no, because the point was...
He was
very popular with Leavers and deeply unpopular with Remainers.
And so he was much less unpopular than Corbyn. Yeah. We need to move on, because I want to make sure that we can bring in some of our live audience to answer some questions. But as I'm in charge of this debate of what year it is, I've got a choice as well. So this is my prediction of what might happen next year.
It is time for you to say to the extremists, we've had enough. For heaven's sake, let's get on with it.
A month ago, the Conservatives had a working majority. It is manifest that they have not received the mandate they sought.
The general election will be held on Thursday, the 10th of October. It will be, of course, the second general election this year.
From all the swings of fortune and the polls and the result, we believe that Labour is now set for having a clear overall majority, although it is still a slender one.
I'm taking you back to 1974, where a Conservative Prime Minister was beset by industrial action, rising energy prices, demands for huge pay rises from across various sectors. So he decided to go to the country, call an election, who governs Britain, and Britain said, not you, Ted Heath. But Harold Wilson didn't get a majority. That was in February 1974. So he fell short of a majority, but was the biggest party. So in the autumn of 1974, we had a second general election. So my prediction is that next year, Keir Starmer will fall short of an overall majority. And whether or not it's next year or drifts into 2025, he'll end in the Lib Dems will ultimately not want to go into a full-blown coalition. So if he wants to have this decade of renewal he talks about and to implement the long-term changes, he'll have to go to the country again. And amongst other people, Brenda from Bristol will be absolutely furious.
But the crucial lesson about 1974, which is uncomfortable for Labour, is that Harold Wilson's ploy of going for a second election did not work. Labour only had a majority of three, and when John Stonehouse went for a rather long swim off the coast of Florida, they lost that majority. And this is the uncomfortable bit for Labour. By 1976, when, of course, the IMF crisis was also on the rise, and there's another financial crisis that the government didn't recover from. By 1976, the Conservatives were ahead in the opinion polls. They put down a vote of no confidence because they were happy to hold an election because they thought they would win. And at that point, the then minority, again, Labour administration, had to do a deal with the then Liberal Party in order to remain in office. And the truth is that although probably, you know, going back to what I was saying about 2010, I suspect if we do get a hung parliament, we won't get a coalition again, that Labour will endeavour to put a King's Speech through. And because neither the Liberal Democrats nor the SNP will throw them out, they will survive in the short run. But unless they can get that second election and win, and given the fiscal circumstances, that's not going to be easy. The point that Labour have to worry about is when they're behind in the opinion polls and they have to look to either the Liberal Democrats or the SNP for support. And we all know what the price is. It's either a referendum on PR or a referendum on Scotland. Choose your poison.
Aisha.
Just on that, I mean, I think in that situation, the Liberal Democrats would support Labour. I don't know if the SNP would.
That's interesting.
Well, which they famously didn't in 79, yeah. Which is what got us the...
Oh, no, they didn't in 79 because the devolution referendum at that previous March had been lost, so therefore the prospects... No, I mean, look, I think the SNP would... If at that point the Labour Party were to accede to holding a second independence referendum, the SNP would help the government.
I don't think Labour's going to do that.
But that's why Labour potentially face a very hard... between a rock and a hard place. They may have to accept that they will go into an election and lose.
Yeah, and on that, you've got this, like, if this is the situation, you've got a very troubled leader in Scotland, you know, Hamza Yousaf having a very, very difficult... This is the chance, if he's in that situation, I'm not going to help you, Labour, it kind of shores him up in Scotland.
Right.
Look, can I just jump in very, very quickly in a single sentence? In 74, Jeremy Thorpe was on every poster up and down the land. The Liberals thought they were going to make a huge breakthrough. They didn't, and that's another warning for the Labour Party.
Yeah.
If the Liberals, Liberal Democrats now undershoot their high expectations.
And if we're looking for Jeremy Thorpe comparisons, every dog in Britain should be worried. Right, let's have a vote. Let's have a vote in here. Put your hands up. So we have the lights on here in the forum here at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Put your hand up if you think we're heading for 1997. Ooh.
Oh, gosh.
Right, OK. Put your hand up if you think you agree with John Curtis we're heading for 2010. Oh, there's a few more there. A few more there. John's bullying of everyone else seems to have paid off. Laura Spirit had two. Do you think it's going to be like 1992 and the Tories win literally no one?
One person there.
One person
That's
there.
Alex Chalk.
That is Alex Chalk. Tory MP for Cheltenham. What was your 1964? Is it going to be like 1964? A small smattering? A smattering, I think we'll call that. Anyone with Patrick Maguire in 1906?
Yes!
Yes. Because you're all going to be using that to show off to your friends. And who wants two elections next year? Who thinks it's going to be like 1974? I think John Curtis has got it. It's a hung parliament. That's where the rumours go. Oh, yeah, give him a round of applause. Next, you, the audience, get to put questions to the panel, and then I get to put questions to one of you when we play the hugely popular quiz. Can he get to number 10? That's next on Times Radio. Yay! Very good. Still joined by Ish Hazarika, John Curtis, Lara Spirit and Patrick Maguire. We'll play Can You Get to Number 10 with somebody here in the audience in a moment. But first, let's take some questions from the audience. Yes, question over there.
If Labour don't win the next election, do you think there will be a leadership contest?
Patrick Maguire.
I'd say it depends how badly they lose. I think if Keir Starmer is Prime Minister after the next election, even without a majority, he becomes very difficult to challenge just because of the psychological impact of Keir Starmer becoming the first Labour Prime Minister in 13 years. But I think if they don't win the election, then all bets as to the internal politics of the Labour Party are basically off, in that the entire 4 years, the past 4 years, have been predicated on a very particular strategy, i.e. the only way we can possibly win an election is by taking inspiration from the tactics we used under New Labour and eradicating the left and saying the left couldn't possibly win. I think if that doesn't pay off, then the internal politics of the Labour Party could very quickly go to quite a dark and chaotic place.
Aisha?
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I think, you know, everybody is towing the line across the Labour movement, from the brothers and sisters in the union movement to, you know, even some of the kind of more left-wing MPs in the socialist campaign group. Everyone's towing the line to get Keir Starmer over the line to get a Labour government. But Patrick is right. If that doesn't happen, the other thing which is interesting is that the leader's office has got a really kind of vice-like grip in terms of, you know, keeping everybody to heel and everyone staying on message. It's quite an authoritarian party at the moment. So if they don't get across the line, I think all hell is going to break loose. Not just from like the Corbynista end of them, but some of the more moderates who behind the scenes will say they wish he was a bit braver, the more soft left people.
There we are. Very good. Right, question over there on the far right, as in the room, not the... What am I doing? Anyway, yes, question over there.
Impact, if any, will the boundary changes and other changes with the Election Act have on the election?
Very good. John Curtis, you of course, boundary changes?
Well, I should say that the official quote-unquote estimates of what the result of the 2019 election would be, would have been under the new boundaries, are expected to be released by the three media main media organisations after the Tamworth and Mid-Bedfordshire by-elections next week. But basically, there is a fairly widespread consensus that the boundary review is not going to have a dramatic impact. I mean, Labour Party already, on the standard arithmetic, need a 12-point majority. Perhaps it's going to be 13 to 14. The principal reason for that, well, there are two. One is that the demography of the geography of Britain has changed, in that some of the country's cities, most notably London, have been gaining population, and London is now pretty much a one-party state for Labour. And secondly, when the Conservatives won a lot of those red wall constituencies, they picked up a lot of constituencies which have relatively small electorates, some of which are, those constituencies are now disappearing. So therefore, the effect of the boundary review in terms of equivalising the size of electorates has the same partisan impact as it would ironically have been if either of the two attempts at a boundary review had been implemented, but neither of which in the end was.
Very good. I think we've got time for one more question. Is there a hand up there? No. Oh, yes, down here. Great. As far away from the microphones as possible. Look, excellent.
Can
well
I
done.
Just,
excellent.
Can I add one other thing? You just that question about that. If Keir does, and I'm being Patrick, I think if Keir does lose, I think you might home back interview King of the North, Andy Burnham.
Yes, of course.
Get his cagoule on. And he hates London and Westminster so much. Why would he want to go back there? Very good. Yes, there, question down here.
Given the effect on the popularity of the Lib Dems last time they went into a coalition, does anyone think they would actually dare do it again?
Lara?
Yeah, some people do. Some people do. The case being, like John says, that if they have red lines on electoral reform, for example, but also on housing, And they can be seen to leverage, you know, as Nick Clegg made the case for last time, you know, better in the tent, better to be able to do that. I think institutional memory in that sense is quite short, and there is a case that many of them might have in the situation where they're looking at the keys of Downing Street and thinking, even if we have, you know, a few seats at the table, that might be worth it. There are genuinely people that think that.
Very good. Right, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, because you've asked the questions, now you're going to answer them. It's time for this. Yes, 10 questions loosely connected to 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better job you get. Take your place alongside our listeners and guests. If you make it all the way to number 10 and get that right, you'll cross the threshold and become our show's Prime Minister. This is how our cabinet currently looks. John the solicitor is Minister without portfolio. David the part-time voiceover artist is Culture Secretary. Miriam Gonzalez-Durantes, the trade lawyer, Nick Clegg's wife, is Environment Secretary. Vicky from the charity Mind is Transport Secretary. Jennifer Kelly from Chester Zoo is Education Secretary. Roger Bailiff, the grandfather from Hampshire, is Health Secretary. Mark, the proposals manager from Sunday Barnes, is Home Secretary. Count Binface is Foreign Secretary. Rosanna Lockwood from Talk TV is Chancellor. And Times Radio's very own James Hansen is still our show's Prime Minister. So who is today's backbencher here in Cheltenham looking for promotion? Who is there? Hello? Hello?
Matthew.
Matthew. Is that your name, or are you just calling me what my gran calls me when
my name as well.
When I've been naughty? You are called Matthew?
Yes.
What do you do, Matthew?
I work in insurance.
Great. That sounds really good.
Should you not be at work?
You've got a job, though, which is good, because most of my listeners are retired, so thank you for coming out. Any particular cabinet job you've got your eye on, Matthew?
Probably sport.
Sport? So you only need to get two right for that, so that's very... Very wise. Come on then, let's do this. Let's play Can You Get to Number 10? Here you go. Question number one, to become Minister without portfolio, complete this well-known phrase, don't judge a book by its...
cover.
That's the right answer. I forgot to bring my bell, so the good people of Cheltenham have brought me an antique-looking bell, which is fabulous, apart from the terrible noise it makes. Oh, there we go. Very good. Question two for culture, media and sport. Which book by Emily Bronte became a smash hit for Kate Bush?
Wuthering Heights.
You're allowed to clap. Question three. Question three for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Beatrix Potter's stories about Peter Rabbit and his friends are linked with which part of the country? Is it the Lake District or the Peak District?
Peak District.
I don't think I need to tell you, Matthew, that was the wrong answer, I'm afraid. So you said you wanted to get culture, media and sports, and you've quite brilliantly ended up with culture, media and sport by only getting two questions right. Round of applause for Matthew. Very good. Well done, everyone. Thank you to my panel, to Aisha Azarika, to John Curtis, to Lara Spear and Patrick Maguire. Aisha, what can people look forward to your show this weekend?
Lots of good things. I'll be on air tomorrow from 4 till 7, and Sunday we'll be doing a look back at the Labour conference. We'll be looking ahead at the SNP conference as well, and bringing you all the latest developments on the unfolding situation in the Middle East.
Very good. Well, that's all we've got time for our show, at least, here in Cheltenham. Don't forget to subscribe to The Times. Tell your friends about Times Radio as well. Patrick McGuire and I are going to go and sign some books now. Whether you like it or not, you're not allowed to leave until you've bought several copies of the book. Massive thank you to all the team who've put us on air and made sure that everything works. But also massive thank you to you. Thank you so much for coming and supporting the Cheltenham Literature Festival for all the work they do here as well. A round of applause for our panel, please. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Many thanks to all of our guests at Cheltenham and all the team who made it happen in front of such a brilliant audience. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're a Times subscriber, you can now get an extra bonus episode every weekend. Just link up your Apple account to your Times subscription. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.